I would think that she would want to at least speak briefly to the new head of the Alaska Republican Party.
Alaska Republicans react to news that Sarah Palin may be running for Senate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new look at king salmon ocean survival in Cook Inlet.
Now, does it really make sense, you know, with a lot of sharks and other things with big teeth in the ocean, to drop them off in a rough neighborhood if, in fact, the survival's worse there?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
With Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell and former candidate Joe Miller in the race, the Republican Senate primary is already being watched closely. Now it's gotten an extra dose of national attention, with former governor and once vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin saying she could be persuaded to run against incumbent Democrat Mark Begich. But while the news made a splash outside, Republicans in the state still haven't heard from her. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Ladies and gentlemen, Governor Sarah Palin! So good to see you! So wonderful to see you! Let me ask you first, Alaska, don't you just love your freedom?
October 28th, 2010. That was the last time former Governor Sarah Palin really inserted herself into Alaska politics. It was at a rally in Anchorage, and she was endorsing Republican candidate Joe Miller in the Senate race. Now, fast forward 3 years later.
Well, there's been talk you might run for senator in Alaska. Have you considered that at all?
I've considered it because people have requested me considering it.
Palin made those comments on Tuesday during a radio show with her Fox News colleague, Sean Hannity. They come after months of speculation over whether she would be open to the possibility and after a national Tea Party group launched a Draft Sarah effort. Republicans see Mark Begich in a vulnerable spot as a Democrat in a red state, and Palin's fans believe she's a strong contender because of her star power and her ability to raise money. But even though her statement is generating a lot of national buzz, party leadership in Alaska hasn't heard a peep from her. Republican Party Chair Peter Goldberg says there's been no communication between him and Palin, ever.
I would think that she would want to at least speak briefly to the new head of the Alaska Republican Party, but no, I've never met the lady, never spoken to her. I have seen her once.
That was at a state convention 5 years ago, and his table was about 30 feet from the podium where she was speaking.
That's the closest I've come to Sarah Palin.
Outside of her 2010 endorsement of Joe Miller, who she could potentially face in the primary if she ran, Palin has kept a low profile in Alaska since she stepped down during her term as governor. She made a comment on Alaska's oil tax system on Facebook in 2011, but has otherwise refrained from getting involved in state policies. She's also had limited contact with elected leaders. While Governor Sean Parnell and Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell weren't available to comment, Republican House Rules Chair Craig Johnson says he hasn't communicated with her at all in his leadership capacities, and House Majority Leader Lance Pruitt says he's never met her. Ralph Seekins is the Republican National Committee man, and of all the people I spoke with, he was the one who had seen her most recently. That was back in February of this year, when Palin stopped at a Lincoln Day dinner for the Republican Party when she was in Fairbanks for the Iron Dog Snow Machine race. Seekins doesn't know of any Republicans who have been in touch with her, and he's not aware of any exploratory committee she has in the state.
Maybe she's just trying to pique the interest or see what the response might be.
Seekins says he's not sure if she's seriously considering a run or if she would even run with his party.
You know, so we've heard that she's also said, well, I might be interested in starting another party other than the Republicans. So, you know, some people say, well, would she run as a Republican or something else? There's a lot of just speculation, confusion, and questioning right now.
Palin has previously distanced herself from the establishment wing of the Republican Party, which has come in conflict with those who support the Tea Party movement. Now, no matter what happens, it looks like that party turmoil could spill over into the primary race, whether Palin jumps in or not.
There's a lot of us that kind of wish it was a one clear candidate, but it doesn't look like it's going to be that way.
Mm-hmm. There's one other person who hasn't heard from Palin. Me. She didn't return a request for comment for this story. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The U.S. Senate is poised to pass a major piece of civil rights legislation for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. It's the first gay rights bill to emerge since the Supreme Court ruled the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional last month. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, both of Alaska's senators will support the bill.
Senate leaders hope to capitalize on growing support for gay rights, especially after the landmark DOMA decision. And if they can't win by passing new laws, they hope to win politically. Senator Lisa Murkowski joined two Republicans and every Democrat on the Labor Committee in voting to move the Employee Non-Discrimination Act to the full Senate.
There should be a fundamental agreement that we have that discrimination should just not be allowed. We should just not operate in a discriminatory manner, in the workplace, in our schools.
ENDA, as the bill is known in Washington lingo, would make it illegal for any employer to fire someone because of their sexual orientation or identity. Identity is a key component. Senator Lamar Alexander, the top Republican on the committee, says he will introduce amendments when the full Senate debates the bill, one to clarify what transitioning means for people undergoing sex changes.
If we can't be specific about what we're talking about, it's hard to expect the employers to be.
The transgender issue has been a roadblock in the past. In 2007, the House passed a version of ENDA only after it stripped out protections for transgender people. That bill won the support of nearly three dozen Republicans, but today's House is far more conservative. Iowa's Tom Harkin chairs the Labor Committee. Long a voice for the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, the retiring senator says current law allows both the government and private sector to discriminate against people, despite growing support for gay rights.
Qualified workers should not be turned away or have to fear losing their livelihood for reasons that have nothing to do with their qualifications, skills, or performance. So let's not mince words, at least I won't. Such practices, I believe, are un-American. They should have no place in any American workplace.
Congress has debated the issue for years, and it's never passed the Senate. But this go-round is likely to be different. More than 50 Democratic senators have signed on as co-sponsors, including Mark Begich. He says he's long supported legal protection for LGBT people. And with Senator Murkowski, the two other committee Republicans, and Maine Susan Collins, supporters are close to the 60-vote threshold. But House leaders have not said they'll bring anything to the floor. Begich says it's worth moving through the Senate, even if the House won't take it up.
We vote with what we think is important and issues that we can pass, but if we sit around and wait for them to pass stuff, I'll be old and gray.
Congress has a full agenda for the next few weeks before it takes off for the August recess, but Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has promised swift action, at least in his chamber. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The third and final NTSB press conference on the plane crash in Soldotna was held late this afternoon in Anchorage. NTSB board member Earl Wehner says a preliminary report will be issued in about a week. The full report will likely take a year before it is concluded. The plane crashed on takeoff Sunday morning just off the Soldotna High runway, killing all 10 people on board. Wehner says investigators are looking at a wide range of concerns. They now have the approximate body weights of the nine passengers and the pilot. They also have the invoices for the amount and type of supplies the plane was carrying and will compile an estimate of the total weight on board. Wehner says the investigators are trying to determine the position of the controls at the time of impact. They do not believe wind shear was a problem. The aircraft was in a stall position with the right wing and nose down. The plane's condition was known to be excellent. Investigators are gathering information on what the plane's activities had been during the 72 hours prior to Sunday's crash. The Army says Fort Wainwright Garrison Commander Colonel Ron Johnson might have been overstating it when he told residents of Pleasant Valley and Two Rivers last Saturday night that artillery training exercises had started the Stewart Creek II wildfire. All questions are now being referred to Major Alan Brown in Anchorage, Army Alaska Public Affairs Chief.
Right now, our position is that we can't make an official determination on exactly what caused it. Are there indications that this fire was directly related to our artillery training in mid-June? Yes, there are. And that's something that we're going to take a close look at when we're able to do a very thorough review of all the information and so forth surrounding the fire.
Brown says their main priority now is getting the fire under control and making sure the citizens of the borough of Fairbanks are safe and can return home. He couldn't say if the Department of Defense would help pay for the firefighting, but he says if citizens feel they've been harmed, there is a process.
Should anyone up in Fairbanks determine that there's damage done to their property or they feel like something was done as a fault of the Army, then we do have a claims process that they can follow through on, and each claim will be looked at individually on its own merit.
Major Brown says the Army will not release their fire mitigation plan that was developed before the artillery testing began because the fire is under investigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tales from a record-breaking summit of Denali.
Suddenly this big white cloud comes in and covers us all up and it starts to snow and it's like, what in the heck is going on?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Admissions representatives from Brown University, MIT, and from Yale University are hosting college information sessions to discuss academic programs, campus life, selective college admissions, and financial aid. On Saturday, July 13th, the session will be in Anchorage in the Assembly Chambers at Lusac Library. And on Sunday, July 14th, the session will be in Juneau at the downtown branch of the Juneau Public Library. Register online at admissions.yale.edu. This message sponsored by Yale University.
King salmon runs to the rivers of Cook Inlet are down again this year. After last year's disastrous fishing season, the Parnell administration launched a five-year, $30 million effort to find out more about salmon life cycles in the ocean. One of the studies underway is trying to figure out where kings and reds are hanging out in the water just before they return to the rivers. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
Canadian researcher Dr. David Welch makes his way out of the cold waters of the Kenai River on a recent Saturday afternoon. He's working beneath the waves of the Kenai and the Kasilof, placing electronic receivers for a tracking study that will help shed some light on exactly where in the water Chinook and sockeye salmon are as they approach the rivers.
The receiver will know the date and time that each fish went by the serial number on the tag, but also the depth of the animal. And that depth information is critical because if we can establish that there's a significant difference in the depth that the Chinook are migrating in, and they're thought to be deeper, then conceivably the nets could be shortened up so that they're hung from the surface but don't hang down as far as they do now. The sockeye fishermen can catch their quota of sockeye, which is big, and they can avoid the bycatch of Chinook.
Dr. Welch has been studying Pacific salmon for decades, first with the Canadian government, and in 2000 he started his own company, Kintama. The goal was to provide science and data that might explain declines in salmon stocks up and down the Pacific coastline of North America.
They're puzzles, like they're multidimensional Rubik's Cube, you know. How do you put all this equipment together? How do you keep it in place? How do you get it back? And then how do you take the data and get something out of it that's actually worthwhile and justifies the cost of doing the research?
Efforts like this can bring together strange bedfellows. Commercial and sport fishing groups stretching from the Kenai Peninsula up to the Matsu Valley recently signed off on a few research areas they all support, including this particular study. None of it's real groundbreaking stuff, but consensus between groups like the commercial-friendly Alaska Salmon Alliance and the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association is almost as rare as king salmon seem to be these days. Arnie Thompson is the executive director for the ASA.
We're all very supportive of expanding genetic analysis because of the diversity in the composition of the stocks that come into Cook Inlet.
Being able to identify things like what river a fish came from could go a long way in helping to tailor management decisions. Set net fishing for sockeye was shut down almost entirely last year, triggered by a shutdown of king fishing in the river. Both sides criticized that decision. They said it was like performing surgery with a chainsaw. The restrictions were too broad.
You know, we can all argue about allocations, but one thing that we can coalesce around is you know, getting better information.
That's Ricky Geese of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association.
And agreeing on what type of research is necessary. And so I think you're seeing some agreement between different user groups and saying, hey, let's work towards getting better information so that we can use for management.
Dr. Welch says his research is showing the saltwater environment to be a dangerous place for salmon. Survivability in the open water is going down, and for any number of reasons. It could be a food source problem. It could be temperature changes. It could be the often cited bycatch problem. He says more ocean research is just beginning to make people down south rethink their management priorities.
Now, does it really make sense, with a lot of sharks and other things with big teeth in the ocean, to drop them off in a rough neighborhood if, in fact, the survival's worse there? We're early days in doing this, and there's legitimately lots of skepticism about whether we're right. But for the first time, people are saying, oh, crap, maybe we should be rethinking this. Maybe it's not appropriate to just say, get them to the ocean as fast as possible. What we thought or what our assumptions were may not be correct.
Dr. Welch is tagging fish throughout the month of July down by Homer. He'll mark 70 sockeye and 70 chinook by surgically implanting tiny transistors. When the fish swim over the array laid out at the mouth of the Kenai and the Kasilof Rivers, the data will come in, and the final report to Fish and Game is due in March. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
QuickPack Fisheries Yukon River salmon buyers across the country can validate their purchases and track their fish from the river to the shelf thanks to a traceability program that serves as a worldwide model. From KYUK in Bethel, Kyle Clayton reports.
QuickPack is a relatively small fishery located in far-removed rural Alaska in the native village of Imonik. It buys its stock from small-scale Yupik commercial fishermen. Its fish travel long distances to get to buyers. And QuickPack tracks that trip like an itinerary.
The fish has a story.
That's Robert Burmeister standing on a dock in QuickPack. He works for Trace Register, a company QuickPack uses to track data that tells that fish's story.
Maybe 25 chum salmon out of a particular area of 334-12. That area is geographically pinpointed in our system.
Everything about the fish is recorded, from when and how many salmon were caught, what section of the river the salmon came from, the gear used to catch them, to how they were processed.
And then eventually, if you go into Whole Foods in the lower 48, you can they have QR codes available that you can scan, and that particular lot of fish, you can see exactly where that fish came from.
Burmeister says QuickPack is doing the job better than most other fisheries, and he works with companies from around the world, all the way from Ecuador to Thailand. QuickPack assistant manager Judy Murdoch says the quality of Yukon River salmon distinguishes it from other fish.
We definitely want people to know that they're getting Yukon River salmon. And we had an incident where somebody in the lower 48 was advertising our fish as a fresh product in their case.
Fish fraud has become common practice throughout the seafood world. From 2010 to 2012, the International Ocean Conservation Group, Oceana, collected more than 1,200 seafood samples from retail outlets in 21 states. And after DNA testing, found that 33% were mislabeled, according to Food and Drug Administration guidelines. According to the FDA, cheaper fish are often substituted for a more expensive species. Someone might think they're tasting red snapper when they're really biting into rockfish. Chum salmon, the species QuickPack primarily sells these days, is typically switched out with pink salmon. Although the FDA doesn't enforce regulations for traceability, National Fisheries Institute Director of Scientific Affairs Barbara Blackstone is working to create a national model for traceability that may act as a guide for the FDA. But those may be a long way off, and Blackstone says many large grocery companies already want the trace data.
And they're dead out serious about it. They want you to be able to prove it, and there's just no way you can do it except for traceability. So the incentive is already there for industry to do the right thing.
QuickPack sells wild, stock, chum, and coho salmon to companies across the U.S. and the U.K. In Imonik, I'm Kyle Clayton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Alaskan Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
For the fourth time this summer, the MV Tustamina's return to service has been pushed back. The Alaska Department of Transportation is now saying that the ferry won't be ready to sail until the end of August. In an inspection last week, the Coast Guard found deficiencies with some of the welding work on the ship's hull. DOT spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the ferry can't sail until the issues are fixed.
The welds definitely need to be watertight, part of the chambers that help the ship float. And so it's important that these welds are done correctly and that we don't have to go back and relook at them, you know, often when the ship is actually in service.
The work and the inspection will probably keep the ferry in dry dock for an additional 2 weeks. After that, the ship will still need to undergo at-sea trials before it can take passengers aboard. 600 passengers were scheduled to sail on the Tustamina between now and the end of August. They'll have the option to rebook for a later date or cancel without penalty. The Tustamina has been in dry dock since November. A Coast Guard helicopter dropped an elite team of explosives experts near Chignik last week. Their mission? To detonate a suspicious bomb that washed up on a remote beach. On paper, it was a standard assignment for the Army's Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, the case still managed to turn up some surprises.
If you ask around, no one in Chignik has heard about a World War II-era bomb washing up on their shores. That's partially because the Peninsula Village is busy with salmon season right now. But it also has something to do with where the bomb was found in early June. Mitrofania Bay is about 20 miles from the village.
Where the bomb was, it was nature. Yeah, it was out there. There's nothing around.
That's Army Specialist Vincent Wallace. He's with the 716th Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team out of Joint Base Almendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. That team got the report of a Fish and Wildlife Service stumbling upon ordnance in Mitrofania Bay. The person took some photos to help identify the piece, but Wallace says they didn't offer a lot of clues.
Well, we knew it was a bomb. The shape and the construction of it led us to believe that it was pretty old. So, that narrowed it down a little bit, but we still had a wide range of options of what it could have actually been.
The only way to know for sure was to examine the item in person. To do that, the Army's explosives team partnered with the Coast Guard and got a ride on their MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter last week. They were able to land directly on the beach where the ordnance was left. Wallace quickly determined that it was made out of aluminum, a metal commonly used for fire or smoke bombs. But this bomb was engraved with Russian, and that's not so common.
I was able to find some Russian Cyrillics that just finished out what it was. I mean, we were able to identify it as a 50-kilogram Russian firebomb.
Firebombs are meant to be dropped from aircraft to clear a path on the ground or destroy targets. They're usually filled with incendiary material like napalm or thermite, but in this case,
it was just an empty casing.
Wallace says the incendiary material might have leaked out over the last 70 years, or it might have been manufactured to be empty for a reason, perhaps to be used for training during World War II. Either way, it presented a hazard. Wallace says his team didn't want to leave the bomb on the beach for someone else to find, and they definitely didn't want to fly back to base with it on board.
Just to be safe, we at that point disposed of it by detonation.
And so, the empty bomb did the impossible. In on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
2013 has been a historic year on Denali. On the same day that a group of descendants of the original summit team made it to the peak, an Alaskan man completed his record-breaking ascent. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Tom Choate of Anchorage recently returned from a history-making trip to the top of Denali. At 78 years old, Choate is the oldest person to stand on the summit of North America's tallest peak. This is his fifth climb on Denali, including his first trek almost exactly 50 years ago.
It's always been an inspiration to go back to that mountain. I've been in love with the mountain ever since then. And so I've tried to go back every decade. And as my body gets older, it gets harder, but it's still fabulous.
Since 1963, a great deal has changed on the mountain. Choate explains what he observed over five decades.
My recollection was even in the middle of July in 63, there was a lot of snow, quite a lot of ice, and obviously it,
you know, whether you call it global warming or whatnot, a lot of material has been melting away. And each decade that I go back, in 93, for example, you had to deviate a little bit from going directly to the summit. In 1963, you could go directly to the summit from what they call the football field. And now, this year, I discovered you're going further and further and further onto the ridge and then following the ridge to the summit because there's just probably 50 feet less snow.
Choate summited on June 28th, but his first summit attempt was 2 days earlier when a rare thunderstorm engulfed the mountain.
And suddenly this big white cloud comes in and covers us all up and it starts to snow and it's like, what in the heck is going on? We sat down at the bottom of this steep hill and suddenly there was this loud clap of thunder and lightning zooming around in the clouds. And people started popping off of the top ridge like flies. And it's like, what is happening? And a guy comes down past me and said, look, my hair's been curled. This big spark jumped off of my shovel into my head. And it's like, wait a minute, Denali, this is 20,000 feet. How can there possibly be lightning storm up here?
Tom Choate describes himself as an old mountain goat. He has done extensive climbing over the last 50 years and has this piece of advice for aspiring adventurers in the Alaska Range.
There's so many places to explore and so many mountains that still even haven't had a foot laid on them. And it's all right there. So don't focus on, oh, I have to have the biggest and highest and all of that kind of thing. Or even return to a place like Denali where an awful lot of other people are. You only have to go maybe 20 miles from Denali. And you can be totally alone for the entire summer and not see anybody. And knock off peaks that nobody's been on. So these challenges are all right here, and you don't want to ever say, ah, you know, that's a little bit too hard. Just go out and be persistent and be ornery like I am.
Choate says he doesn't have any plans for 2023 yet, but that he'll probably find something interesting to do. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Kyle Clayton in Bethel, Stephanie Joyce and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.